Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is World War Against Fascism, Remembering China's Role in the Victory, a webinar held by the International Manifesto Group and Friends of Socialist China on September 21st, 2025. The webinar celebrated the 80th anniversary of Japan's surrender, marked in China with spectacular celebrations attended by an array of heads of state, focusing in particular on the contributions of the Chinese and other Asian forces, which are forgotten in the largely Eurocentric narrative of the Second World War. Participants assessed the renewed threats to China and other Asian countries emanating from the U.S., Japan, and the rest of the capitalist world. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. Also, some of the subject matter in this episode is intended for mature audiences only. We'll start with moderator Radhika Desai, convener of the International Manifesto Group.
On the 3rd of September this year, Beijing put on the most impossibly perfect military parade seen in recent history, or perhaps even in history, as the government of the People's Republic of China celebrated 80 years since Chinese, Korean, Mongolian, and largely communist-led resistance forces scored their heroic victory against Japan in the World War against fascism. In the Western press, one could detect three main strands of commentary. The Western neoliberal establishment, which is in power in nearly all Western countries except the United States, could only protest impotently as their Eurocentric narratives about the Second World War having been won by European and US forces were displaced. They could only scoff unconvincingly as the People's Republic of China made its rightful claim to be considered the leading force behind victory in the Pacific theater of the greatest war humankind had suffered. Russia, the successor state to the Soviet Union, had also made its own equally rightful claim regarding the European theater just months earlier, an event which we also commemorated here on the International Manifesto Group. The Western neoliberal establishment had to endure these forces having the temerity to insist on the fundamental historical point that it needed communist forces to win the war caused by capitalism and its imperialism, and that without these communist forces, the homelands of capitalism would have succumbed to fascism. Worse, the US-led West had to look on aghast as China's military hardware, in many cases surpassing US weaponry technologically, paraded down Chang'an Avenue and across Tiananmen Square. And to top it all, they had nightmares about a new, fearsome international alliance being formed. Whereas the heads of state of all socialist countries were gathered there for the first time, the West could only fix its fearful gaze on Presidents Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un, flanking President Xi as his guests of honor, and President Pezeshkian standing not far behind. In the throes of their tortuous nightmare, the Western press let fly a barrage of new epithets. These people constituted the axis of upheaval, the axis of aristocracies, a quartet of chaos, and even a deadly quartet. They venomously coined a new acronym, CRINK, referring to China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. Needless to say, to most around the world, it was clear that Western democracy had been hollowed out for decades, that the US-led West was the fomenter-in-chief of chaos, that the Chinese government and the governments of most of those on the podium on the 3rd of September enjoyed a deeper and broader legitimacy than any government in the West, and that these countries were increasingly forming the Pacific core in a world buffeted by storms originating in the West. The second strand of commentary was, of course, President Trump himself. He is himself a symptom of the crisis of the US-led Western neoliberal establishment. He issued one of his characteristically snide messages. He said on Truth Social, "May President Xi and the wonderful people of China have a great and lasting day," whatever that is, "of celebration. Please give my warmest regards to Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un as you conspire against the United States of America. End of quote. Whether the occupant of the White House had anything serious to convey or was simply flying off the handle in his confusion is anybody's guess. What we do know is that he is caught between his desperation for a trade deal with China, the deal that alone stands in the way of the US's economic and the Republicans' electoral disasters, and his desire to appear to be the one thing he is not, namely in control. Finally, an academic undercurrent sought to downplay the Chinese communist role in the war. Even Harvard's Rana Mitter, who has done so much to contest Eurocentrism and bring the forgotten war in the Pacific to world attention, opposed communist Chinese claims. Historians would say that overall, he declaimed, the majority of the wartime effort, including the set battles, were actually fought by China's nationalists. He relied on little more than stereotypes about communism to dismiss the People's Republic's claims as mere self-aggrandizing propaganda. In this webinar, we need to uncover the realities of the communist role in defeating fascism because these realities are, well, realities. And because in a world where fascist forces are returning, recalling this has become more urgent than ever before. Just as in the interwar years, fascism today is simply the foaming crest of a wave of right-wing forces that has been rising throughout the neoliberal decades. In the homelands of capitalism and beyond, they are forming movements and parties and taking office municipally, provincially, and sometimes even nationally. Their growing strength was only underlined last weekend by the frightening gathering of 150,000 people in a Unite the Kingdom demonstration organized by fascist forces in the heart of London. These fascist or proto-fascist, you can take your nomenclatural pick, these forces are locked in a macabre tango with the neoliberal establishment of most Western countries. Both forces are committed to the preservation of today's senile, productively debilitated, financialized, predatory, and speculative capitalism, which is fast losing legitimacy. Both combine force and fraud, though in differing emphases. While fascist forces incline to force, the neoliberal establishments incline to fraud. While against the fraudulent neoliberals, the fascists can appear more honest, though they are not. Against the threatening fascists, the neoliberals can appear kinder, though they are also not. Both involve inflicting the same intolerable economic system and political repression on the people at home. Meanwhile, abroad, a combination of war, sanctions, color revolutions, and the use of fascist proxies, as in Ukraine and Israel, seek to compel compliance with imperialism from a world increasingly capable of refusing such compliance. Only well-organized and consolidated left forces can rise to the major economic, political, and cultural challenges of our time. The construction of a viable and effective anti-imperialist left is the only way today, and setting the historical record straight is the first step towards it. Okay, so our next speaker will be Professor Ken Hammond. Professor Ken Hammond is a historian at the University of New Mexico and one of the foremost critical scholars of China in the United States.
Thank you, Radhika. It's wonderful to be here. When I think about China's role in defeating fascism back in the 1930s and 40s, it's not really so much a matter of China as a political organization defeating this. It's the Chinese people, the people of China who fought to resist against the Japanese invading their country. And those people were also, of course, involved in struggle on multiple fronts and being led by the Communist Party. And of course, with the Red Army, Chinese Red Army, as the leading fighting force. They faced a challenge that encompassed, of course, the immediate and most pressing task of resistance against the Japanese invaders, but also that took place in the context of a conflict within China, which had been going on since the 1920s between the Communist Party and the fascist nationalists. We should remember always that at the same time that the Red Army and the CPC was fighting to maintain itself, fighting to survive. The nationalist government under Chiang Kai-shek was receiving military aid, training and weapons and machinery from Nazi Germany. So, you know, the fact that eventually the Axis, the fascist Axis, comes to settle on Japan and Germany and Italy, certainly Chiang Kai-shek flirted, more than flirted, with fascist links to Germany in the mid-1930s. And so the CPC and the Red Army find themselves waging a conflict, waging a struggle against Japan, but also in the context of an ongoing struggle with the nationalists. And that was something which, again, as was mentioned, the nationalists, I don't want to suggest that the nationalists did nothing in resisting the Japanese. Certainly, there were many patriotic fighters in the nationalist forces and even among some of the officer corps and all. But at the top of that government was a regime that was not interested in prioritizing the war with Japan. They did what they had to protect themselves and survive, but they didn't really play the main leading role in trying to defeat the Japanese, trying to stop the Japanese, get rid of the Japanese, and end Japanese imperialism overall. That was the Red Army. That was the Communist Party. And that was the people of China. The party, of course, you know, leading that struggle, trying to organize and guide that struggle, and the Red Army being the primary fighting forces, but guerrilla forces, local groups around North China that came out of the villages, you know, they took part in this fighting as well. And it was that mass movement quality or the resistance against Japan that really, really drove it and made it as effective as it was. And of course, tying down well over a million Japanese troops in China during the war, that had a crippling effect on Japan's overall military capabilities. In tandem, or perhaps in triplicate with all of those, with those two, was the deeper struggle, the struggle, the real profound struggle, the class struggle that the Communist Party was leading. This was the struggle to overthrow the old system, the system of landlord capitalism, industrial capitalism in the cities. And that, you know, they experimented even while fighting against the invaders and resisting the efforts of the nationalists to destroy them. They were able to experiment with land reform, with transforming the old remnants of ancient family systems and things like that. So these struggles, they really fought on three fronts: against the Japanese, against the nationalists, and against the old ruling class, the old ruling classes. So I think we really want to recognize that struggle and the ability of the communist leadership to pursue that was quite remarkable, quite remarkable. And that victory, those successive victories, the defeat of Japan, the defeat of the nationalists, and the victory of the revolution and the empowerment of the people, the working people of China, that takes place eventually based on you know, their devotion and their commitment to leadership. So mobilizing the people, working with the people, serving the people, this was the guiding principle. And of course, the contrast with the anti-fascist struggles which took place in Western Europe, you know, the United States, Britain, the French government in exile, certainly they were opposed to fascism because, as was pointed out, you know, fascism was also opposed to, you know, the predominance of the capitalist ruling classes. In fascism, the state tries to direct the economy rather than the state serving as an instrument of the capitalist elites. And so, you know, those elites, they wanted to get rid of fascism so that they could reassert their power and reclaim their privileges over the people in Europe as well. And the same was true, of course, in China, that Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists resist the Japanese, not in order to create a more just and equitable China, but in order to regain their capacity to exploit the Chinese people more effectively themselves. So this struggle on three fronts goes on, comes to culmination over Japan in 1945, the defeat of the nationalists by 1949, and the ongoing victory over capitalism and the old landlord capitalist system to see China build its socialist future, to see China embark upon this long and continuing prolonged struggle to create that society of socialism, justice, equity that the people fought for and continue to work for and labor for today. So I think this is a moment when hats off, you know, to the Chinese people, hats off to anti-fascist fighters everywhere during those critical years in the middle of the 20th century. And today, wherever we see the threat of fascism reviving, denying the history that if we forget it, we're going to repeat it. And, you know, we need to be alert to these dangers, and we need to dedicate ourselves, just as the CPC and the Red Army and the Chinese people did, to this struggle, however long it takes, however many years it takes, because this is the only way that we're going to be able to create the future that we all dream of.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is World War Against Fascism, Remembering China's Role in the Victory, a webinar held by the International Manifesto Group and Friends of Socialist China on September 21st, 2025. We just heard Ken Hammond, historian and China scholar. Next up is Jenny Clegg, an activist and author of China in a Multipolar World.
What I'd like to talk about is first, just briefly, some of the overall context of World War II, then the impact on China, and why China's contribution to the defeat of fascism has been erased from history in the West, and why we should remember. So, first of all, taking the date back to 1931, Japan's invasion of Manchuria, gives us a longer time frame to take in the international context. First, that the world was in a state of flux. Britain, still the lead imperialist power, had been catastrophically hit by the 1929 Wall Street crash, leaving a power vacuum. And Japan stepped in, turbocharged by its rapid militarization, and its aggression really shattered the fragile efforts of the League of Nations to build some structure of peace. Beyond words of condemnation, the world's major powers really failed to act, and this emboldened Japan and the forces of fascism worldwide. So we had the Nazi election in 1932, Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, Franco's coup in Spain. Then in 1936, Japan signed the Anti-Comintern Pact with Nazi Germany, and this made its subsequent further invasion into China in 1937 as an act of world war. In Manchuria, local resistance was brutally suppressed, but Chiang Kai-shek continued to concentrate his forces against the communist bases until 1937, when he finally agreed to join the CPC-initiated United Front. So up to 1941, the Chinese people stood virtually alone. Britain leaned towards appeasement, even closing China's supply route, the Burma Road, in 1940. And US loans came too little too late. The Soviet Union did supply military and financial aid under a secret agreement with the Kuomintang from 1937 to 1940. And anti-fascist and anti-imperialist groups in the West also rallied, inspired by Edgar Snow's Red Star Over China, published in 1937. And the China Campaign Committee, which I mentioned before in Britain, for example, embraced China's cause as Britain's cause in the fight against global fascism. Within China, the crisis awakened a national collective consciousness. In the last months of 1937, as the big coastal cities of Shanghai and so on fell, millions of traumatized refugees fled inland with no clear destination and few belongings. Inland cities and Red Army bases were overwhelmed. Now, China, of course, was one of the poorest countries in the world. There was hardly any medical care. There were no refugee camps. There were no international relief agencies. Reports from the battlefields were absolutely horrific, with bodies lying all over the place, dead and wounded, without any medical assistance. So the Chinese people had to rely on themselves. The entire population rallied in the war effort to provide health and social welfare, care for war orphans, and groups of refugees organized into cooperatives to produce blankets, uniforms, all sorts of goods. That was the famous Indusco movement, or Gung He, Work Together, initiated by Rui Ali and Helen and Edgar Snow. The country was the most transformed by war, socially, culturally, politically. Class and gender barriers were shattered as westernized city elites began to rebuild their lives in the semi-feudal hinterland, the urban and the rural mixing together. both nationalists and communists sought to raise consciousness through mass rallies, the nationalists in the early part of the war, that is, and mass campaigns popularizing Chinese culture using folklore forms to create a modern culture of resistance. That was important. Between 1937 and 1945, the CPC areas expanded from a population of 1 million with an army of 30,000 to a population of 100 million and an army of 900,000. In these areas, war was a crucible for the development of Marxism-Leninism, with Mao's theories of new democracy, the relationship between theory and practice, and the systematizing of contradictions of imperialism, feudalism, and capitalism, so as to coordinate the nationalist movement and the peasant and the working class movements in a long-term strategy advancing resistance into revolution. So in 1941, Japan's expansion into the Pacific forced Churchill and Roosevelt to recognize China as an ally and an equal, and the UK abrogated the unequal treaties, except for Hong Kong, in 1943. And as an allied power, China's United Front became a founding member of the United Nations in 1945. So we can say Japan's defeat was brought about by China, the US, and the UK together, with the Soviet Union turning east in August 1945. But then, with Japan's surrender, US and UK priorities changed. From inter-imperialist rivalries, the aim was now to, and I quote, maintain Anglo-Saxon superiority over post-war Asia. In reality, though, the war in Asia was a war of liberation, as the defeat of worldwide fascism gave way to surging movements for national liberation. The end of World War then did not end war in Asia, as the European colonial powers set out to regain their hold. As far as China was concerned, the people had not fought so hard for so long against Japanese imperialism, merely to become hostage to the US. And as we know, after 4 years of civil war, the CPC, still leading a democratic front, defeated the Kuomintang despite its US backing. As Mao saw it when interviewed by Edgar Snow in 1936, China's revolution was a key factor in world revolution. And so we saw continuing revolutions in the East with the defeat of the Dutch in Indonesia in 1949, also after 4 years of conflict, the Vietnamese defeating the French in 1945. That was just after the Koreans had fought the US-led UN forces to a standstill. And whilst in Malaya, communist-led guerrilla struggle continued to oppose British colonial rule up to 1960. So this myth about the US World War II victory was to play a critical role in the restructuring of imperialism from direct colonial rule into a US hegemonic neocolonialism, simultaneously isolating China's collectivist resistance and sidelining the UN. I think that there are three lessons that I would like to draw from this about the dangers of the world situation today, about China's intentions, and about how we stop things spiraling out of control. Just as in the 1930s build-up to World War, we now see the international order in a state of flux. With the US in relative decline, unilateral military actions proliferating, the US bombing of Iran, Israel on Qatar, all alongside the ongoing war in Ukraine and the Gaza genocide. And again, all this carries on with no restraint. In the 1930s, even though the fascist elements were not coordinating until later, there was not just a series of disconnected events between 31 and 37. Japan's invasion of Manchuria emboldened others, so we had a snowballing effect into the World War. So this, it seems to me, is the history that China is calling on the world to reflect on. But as China itself also steps into the vacuum, we are told in the West that it wants to dominate the world, to displace the US as world leader. And so things are turned on their head. China, our ally, is our enemy. And the former Axis powers, Germany and Japan, are our allies and must be rearmed. In fact, China's real intentions remain obscured by the failure to acknowledge its role in World War II, that China made great sacrifices in the past in order to become part of a new peaceful world order, and that has been its enduring goal. So this is my first takeaway from September the 3rd, China's resilience in the pursuit of peace and UN values. You know, the worst of the situation today, in my opinion, is how the UN has been rendered irrelevant when we need it most. Apparently, Western powers will not accept an organization with China as an equal. They continue to deny the real victory of World War II, which was the fact that fascism was defeated through international solidarity of people across the world. And that's my second takeaway, the need to rebuild international solidarity. We have to think about our shared future, the Chinese are saying, because of what history tells us about our shared past. I think that that is the deeper meaning of the VJ Day commemoration. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is World War Against Fascism, Remembering China's Role in the Victory, a webinar held by the International Manifesto Group and Friends of Socialist China on September 21st, 2025. We just heard Jenny Clegg, an activist and author of China in a Multipolar World. Next up is journalist, writer, and educator KJ No. Please note that some of the subject matter in this segment is intended for mature audiences only.
I think that one of the things that we have to remember in China's victory over fascism 80 years ago is, of course, that World War II started in 1931 for China in the invasion of Shenyang in Liaoning province. And the human costs, as others have already said, were incredible. 35 million killed, 10 million enslaved, I'll get to that later, of which 400,000 were comfort women. We know about the Nanjing Massacre, and we also know about Unit 731. One of the things that I want to highlight is China fought the Japanese fascists, and it defeated them at great cost. But I would argue that this war is not over, and in fact, it has continued to the current moment. Many of you saw the celebration parade. The Western media highlighted the advanced weaponry, but none of them highlighted the fact that 80,000 doves were released at the end of the parade, signifying China's desire, ardent desire for peace. And another thing that most people will have missed is these are the combat veterans of the war. And if you look at them carefully, I want you to look at their uniforms and tell me what's missing. And if you said rank insignia, you would be right, because the Chinese People's Army was an army of equals. It did not have ranks. And for 97 years of its existence, for 49 of those years, up to the 1980s, the Chinese People's Liberation Army did not have ranks. And I think what this tells us is that what we have essentially is a people's war and a people's army that resulted in a people's victory. That is to say, you have an army of equals building a society of equals. And I think nothing speaks to that more powerfully than the fact that we had truly a people's army. The only way you could distinguish between high-ranking people and low-ranking people was actually the number of pockets. The officers had more pockets because they had to carry notebooks. But my point is that I think it's premature to say that Japanese imperialism or imperialism was defeated in this war. As William Faulkner said, the past is never dead. It is not even past. I just want to show you some images of the Nanjing Massacre, and I also encourage people to see Dead to Rights, the movie. The image on the right is a young woman who has been raped. She is in a catatonic state. I caution people that these images are graphic. These are mass killings. These are people being used for bayonet practice. These are executions. Same thing here. You can see the mass bodies. You can see the babies. These are women and children who have been raped. You can see the blood streaming from their genitals. Once again, I apologize for the graphic nature, but this is what really happened. And of course, we know it started with the Mukden in 1931. It was a false flag attack. And when the Japanese went and created this puppet state, it created a genocidal, totalitarian, capitalist slave state, the likes that have never been seen in history. 10 million were conscripted into slavery. It was actually Japan's industrial powerhouse and granary, essentially what gave Japan the industrial power to take over all of Asia. And scholars have referred to it as a necro-capitalist state. I'll explain that further. And they've also referred to it as the Belgian Congo of the Far East. Started out with Chinese coolies from Shandong and Hebei. They did all the physical labor for the Japanese colonial system. But it was also a kind of drug-fueled gangster capitalism, where you had Japanese pimps and drug traffickers in the treaty ports in China who were then became policy holders, policy leaders, and officials. And so there was massive drug and human trafficking, and it also has been completely whitewashed in the Western mind, you know, because of the Cold War. What the Japanese imperialists has done has been completely whitewashed, so much so that, for example, Wendy Sherman at the State Department told the Comfort Women essentially just to get over it. So let's talk a little bit more about this necro-political state. The coolies that originally went to, that were in Manchuria, were turned into slave laborers. The pimps became state officials and also were involved in narco trafficking. Sex workers became comfort women, and then women were kidnapped and turned into comfort women. And it really was a genocidal, necro-capitalist fascist state. A good recounting of this is done in the scholarship of Mark Driscoll. And he talks about, you know, some of the actual manifestations of this. We know that the Nissan company and Mitsui Mitsubishi actually got started in Manchukuo. In fact, this is kind of the origins of the Japanese Zaibatsu capitalist conglomeration. In Manchuria, or northern China, really, the northeast of China, the Orichin people, they're a deer-herding ethnic minority of China. The Japanese simply genocided them. There were 1,000 left after the Japanese occupation. Same thing with the Hurza people. We think at least 90% of the population were killed. After the Japanese left, there were 300 left. And of course, this was facilitated by the East Asia Development Board. This was the kind of ministry responsible for industrial development in China. And essentially, it implemented a system of forced labor. By 1942, there were already 5 million enslaved in the mines and the war industries. And this was led, the director of the East Asia Development Board was General Yanagawa Heisuke, who was actually the commander responsible for the Nanjing massacre. And he institutionalized slave labor in Manchukuo. The world's deadliest mine disaster, the second worst industrial accident in history, happened in Manchukuo. There was a coal dust explosion in the mines. And in order to put out the fire and to save the mine, the Japanese simply sealed the mine pit and trapped 1,518 Chinese workers. And they all died. For the Japanese, the pit was more important than the miners. As I said before, the primitive accumulation of Manchukuo involved narco trafficking, sexual slavery, and slave labor. And at one point, by 1937, it was responsible for 90% of all white drugs, that is, you know, opium and other narcotics, came from Manchuria. Vespa is an Italian chronicler. He, you know, talks about the number of drug and criminal activity, and also that the Japanese Imperial Army was involved in the drug traffic. Now, a very important character of Manchuria was Shiro Ishii, who was the founder of the Japanese Biological Warfare Unit. And we know that subjects who had the misfortune to be kidnapped and taken to the Biological Warfare Unit were exposed to poison gas, cyanide, phosgene. They were infected with plague, anthrax, cholera, encephalitis, STDs. They were subjected to frostbite testing. They were subjected to live vivisection. And we know that at least 10,000 people were medically experimented, tortured, and killed. So these are some of the key figures associated with Manchukuo: Ishii, Kishi, and Masao Tagaki. I'll get to them. This is Shiro Ishii. He was rehabilitated by the United States because he turned over his research and he helped develop Fort Detrick. He was hired by the U.S. military to train the U.S. on biological warfare. And there's very, very good evidence that he was involved in the bio-warfare campaign during the Korean War. Nobusuke Kishi was the Vice Minister of Industrial Development in Manchukuo. He's the person who turned it into an industrial powerhouse. He's the person who signed the decree calling for the use of slave labor. And during that period, an average of 1.5 million Chinese were taken away to work as slaves every year. And he referred to them as dogs who would only understand brute force. An example of this necropolitical capitalism was the Fushun coal mine in Manchuria. There were 40,000 men working as miners, of which 25,000 had to be replaced every year because they were dying in the mines. And of course, he was rehabilitated by the United States. He became prime minister. Here you see him living it up with Chiang Kai-shek and other high-ranking officials. And then decades later, his grandson, Shinzo Abe, also became prime minister. This is another important person. You may not know him as well. This is Masao Tagaki. He was an artillery and counterinsurgency officer in the Manchukuo Imperial Army. Most of us know him as Park Chung-hee. He was the U.S. Quisling who became the dictator of South Korea. And he was responsible for tracking down a very important person in Manchuria, a guerrilla leader who had the status of a Che Guevara of Northeast Asia. He was responsible for tracking him down. He never was able to track him down. So I won't go over the comfort women or the Yakuza or the industrialists, but I do want to point out that what we are seeing right now in the Pacific is a successor imperialism. What do I mean by that? Just as the French, who were the colonizers of Vietnam and Indochina, turned over their colonial project to the United States, we see the same thing. The United States, not only did it rehabilitate the Japanese fascists, but it took on all of their colonies. And so all the former Japanese colonies, that is to say Korea, Taiwan province, the Ryukyu Islands, that is to say Okinawa and the Philippines, these were all Japanese colonies, as well as Guam and Wake Island. And so the United States has become the successor imperialist. And it is currently, from the standpoint of global history, it's doing exactly the same thing that the Japanese are doing, which is to say that it is preparing for war against China. I believe that the march, the parade, is a strong message that sends a message to the United States and to Japan that China has defeated the fascists and that it is strong and it will never be subjugated again, and that it seeks peace, but it will not ever allow itself to be subjugated in the same manner that happened before. The key thing to understand is that the United States is a dying and waning empire, but it still has some tremendous strengths. One of the strengths that it has is, of course, its control over aspects of the financial system. The second key strength, or its superpower, is its exorbitant military power. And then the third, which is not so obvious, but is equally important and really undergirds the rest of its power, is its capacity for marketing, public relations, and advertising. No country excels at public relations and propaganda as much as the United States. And it's so good at it that the Western populations don't even realize that they're being propagandized. You know, Charles Baudelaire said the devil's greatest trick was convincing the world that he didn't exist. The greatest feat of Western propaganda is convincing its population that they are not propagandized. And so because of that, there is such an extraordinary task ahead of us But the first thing to understand here is that the U.S. military considers warfare to be conducted in six domains: air, land, sea, and three domains of space: outer space, cyberspace, and mental space. In other words, your mind is literally seen as a terrain of battle. And what the United States seeks to do, especially as it escalates to war, is it seeks to control the information sphere. It seeks to dominate the information sphere, so much so that we can say that what it really does is it creates a no critical thinking zone. Just as it creates a no-fly zone before it starts attacking with infantry, it also creates a no-think zone before it goes to war. So if you understand that, and you understand that your mind is a terrain of contestation, then the job of every individual is to degauss their minds, to degauss their brains, and to resist occupation and colonization by this massive propaganda apparatus that is currently in the process of manufacturing consent for war and shutting down all critical and opposition voices for peace. That's the first thing to do. And you have to understand that this is something where you can actually be involved. You actually have the tools, because technically it is your mind. How can you tell when something is propaganda? Let me give you three very simple benchmarks. Anytime you see a report and it uses the term CCP, that is propaganda and disinformation, because the actual name for the party is the Communist Party of China, the CPC. And when the propagandists refuse to use the term that the Chinese refer to themselves with, it is actually an insult and an act of contempt. It is like using the N-word against the Chinese. And anybody who used the N-word, you would know immediately that they are not to be trusted. And likewise, anybody who uses the term CCP, you know that they're working in the domain of propaganda. Here's another signal. Anytime you get a message and it is contradictory, you know that you're working in the domain of propaganda. China is so weak, it's going to collapse the next minute. And at the same time, they say China is so big and powerful, it's going to overtake the world. Both of these things cannot be true at the same time. There is no such thing as Schrödinger's China. And because of that, you know that you're working in the domain of propaganda, because those contradictions are irresolvable. In other words, they're lies. And the third way you also know you're in the domain of propaganda is when you see any statement about China which is followed by "at what cost." This is what The Guardian and The New York Times do. They all say China is saving the planet, reducing greenhouse gases, but at what cost? Now you know that you're going to be deluged with propaganda. So those are some simple signals, but the key work is for us to be assiduous in critical thinking. Really, you have to think of this as a kind of a mental martial art where you're constantly degaussing and resisting the propaganda. This is hard work, but it's essential, and it's the first place we start. And once having derived truth from facts, we share those facts and we build out a constellation of networks of solidarity that share the truth with each other. One more thing, I just wanted to talk about the Global Governance Initiative. It's one of three global initiatives: the Security Initiative, the Development Initiative, the Civilizational Initiative, and it kind of caps those three with a kind of institutional infrastructure that is focused on bringing back rule of law into the international system. The U.S. has run a rogue state with vigilante approaches and aggression to everything. This is an attempt to corral the world back towards the ideals of the UN Charter. And I think it's extraordinarily important. And it also ties into the SCO and the Tianjin Declaration, which is creating the foundations for this global governance by reasserting sovereignty of all countries. That is to say, the sovereignty of national sovereignty, but also digital sovereignty, energy sovereignty, and financial sovereignty. These are critical issues that are being built out. And then the last piece I'll say is about Hiroshima. I don't want to quibble about this because it's kind of unseemly to quibble about these kinds of things, but I do not believe that Hiroshima was the worst crime of the fascists. I mean, as I pointed out, Manchuria itself was much, much worse. Nanjing was much, much worse in terms of sheer human numbers. I don't know if we can actually compare these things, but it is an important question to ask is, you know, why does Japan go along with the United States after having been so brutally bombed? And the answer to that is simply the comprador class and the structure of Japanese governance was created by the United States. In particular, the LDP, the ruling party, which has ruled as one party rule since 1955, was created by the CIA through CIA funding, through an alliance of war criminals, organized gangsters, the Yakuza, and unrepentant military industrialists. These all came together and they created the LDP, and they've essentially controlled Japanese politics since 1955. And so if we understand that, then we also have to understand that the challenge is to have people-to-people relations and to understand that the government is not a reliable partner. Last and quick comment is that the Hiroshima atomic bomb was 15 kilotons. Currently, as the U.S. escalates to war against China, it is preparing nuclear war and it is preparing tactical nukes for use against China. Those tactical nukes have a maximum yield of between 20 to 360 kilotons. In other words, what the U.S. considers to be a usable tactical nuclear bomb against China is 24 times more powerful than Hiroshima. So I think we need to remember these things and understand the risks and the what's really at stake.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is World War Against Fascism, Remembering China's Role in the Victory, a webinar held by the International Manifesto Group and Friends of Socialist China on September 21st, 2025. We just heard journalist, writer, and educator K.J. No. Next up is Keith Bennett, co-editor of Friends of Socialist China.
On May the 8th, 1945, people in Britain celebrated VE Day. 6 years of all-out war in Europe against Nazi and fascist tyranny had come to a victorious conclusion. But whilst the nation struggled with a collective hangover the next day, it did so with the knowledge that the war in East and Southeast Asia and in the Pacific continued, and nobody at that stage could be sure for how long. While, as events transpired, the war in Asia Pacific was to last just a few more months, due not least to the decisive intervention of the Soviet Red Army, rather than to the criminal bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, this does serve to underline the fact, as we've heard already from other speakers, of course, that the World Anti-Fascist War began first in the East, specifically in China, and that it lasted the longest. The Chinese People's War of Resistance against Japanese aggression began, as we've heard, in 1931, after Japan rigged up the puppet state of Manchukuo in northeast China. This in turn became a nationwide war of resistance in 1937 with the Marco Polo or Lugu Bridge incident heralding Japan's all-out invasion. At that time, while progressive people around the world rallied to the support of China, the only state to take a clear-cut stand in support of the Chinese people's resistance was the USSR. And this fact clearly impacted on the entire geopolitical pattern in the region. The Soviet contribution to the defeat of Japanese militarism did not begin with the declaration of war on August 8, 1945, the date agreed between the USSR, the United States, and Britain at Yalta. A key front was opened more than 10 years previously in the Mongolian People's Republic, with hundreds of clashes on the border with the so-called Manchukuo starting from January 1935. As tensions mounted, it clearly became a matter of when, not if, a major confrontation would take place between Soviet and Japanese forces in or adjacent to Mongolia. The stakes would be high. A decisive Soviet defeat would likely prompt a full-scale Japanese invasion of the Soviet Union, with the equal likelihood that this would prompt a further attack on the Soviet Union from the West, whereas a decisive Soviet victory would contain the Japanese threat for a considerable period and allow the Soviet Union relative freedom to devote its attentions to preparation to meet an attack from the West. That major confrontation was to take place from May to September 1939. Known as the Battle of Khalkhin Gol, after the river of the same name, this little-known conflict actually deserves to be known as a key battle that shaped the entire subsequent course of the Second World War. One Western military historian has described the significance of the Battle of Khalkhin Gol as follows. Although this engagement is little known in the West, it had profound implications on the conduct of World War II. It may be said to be the first decisive battle of World War II because it determined that the two principal Axis powers, Germany and Japan, would never geographically link up their areas of control through Russia. Had the USSR been forced to fight on two fronts simultaneously, the outcome of the war may have been very different, both in Asia and in Europe, and with cataclysmic consequences for humanity. Two factors were crucial in this. Besides the clear-cut Soviet victory at Khalkhin Gol, what must be acknowledged above all is the Chinese people's heroic resistance. Alongside the great patriotic war of the Soviet peoples, it was the Chinese people who shouldered the greatest burden and made the greatest national sacrifice in the world people's struggle against fascism. It was with the strong leadership of the Communist Party of China, which called for nationwide resistance by the whole Chinese nation and people first and most consistently, and with a national united front that would not have been created or sustained without the party's consistent, persevering, skillful, tenacious, and self-sacrificing efforts that, in the words of Hu Jintao, for a long time we Chinese contained and pinned down the main forces of Japanese militarism in the China theater and annihilated more than 1.5 million Japanese troops. The struggles of the Chinese, Soviet, and Mongolian peoples were also closely coordinated with that of the Korean people, who, their country having been colonized in 1910, had suffered under the iron heel of Japanese imperialism for longest. Although the Korean people had never ceased their fight for independence, for example, with their Declaration of Independence in the March 1, 1919 movement, as in China, the bourgeois nationalists proved themselves incapable of effectively leading the anti-fascist, anti-imperialist struggle. That task fell to the Korean communists led by Kim Il-sung, as KJ has just intimated, a brilliant guerrilla commander who for much of this time was based in northeast China. In the summer of 1942, the Soviet Union took the initiative to form the International Allied Forces, together with Chinese and Korean communists and other patriots. Kim Il-sung wrote in his memoirs with the Century, "With the organization of the IAF, a great change took place in our armed struggle. It can be said that with the formation of the Allied forces as a turning point, we switched from the stage of our joint struggle with the Chinese people to the stage of extensive joint struggle, which meant an alliance of the armed forces of Korea, China, and the Soviet Union, the stage of a new common front joining the mainstream of the worldwide anti-imperialist, anti-fascist struggle." Of course, within the overall context of the anti-fascist war, different forces had different class natures and hence different war aims and strategies. And naturally, other people have dwelt on this too. So just as bourgeois governments in Europe, from France to Norway to Greece, folded in the face of Nazi aggression, so supposed British colonial strongholds and fortresses like Hong Kong and Singapore fell to the advancing Japanese forces like skittles in a bowling alley. Throughout the region, it was the communists and the communist-led forces who led the resistance, fighting a protracted people's war, tying down the Japanese imperial army, surrounding them, and ultimately defeating them in China, Korea, Vietnam, Burma, Malaya, Indonesia, the Philippines, and elsewhere. These different class interests essentially fighting for liberation or fighting for empire, clearly manifested themselves on the conclusion of the war. Hence, Ho Chi Minh's declaration of Vietnam's independence on September 2, 1945, was met with British forces attempting to control the country until the French colonialists could return, this in turn leading to three further decades of war that would sweep across and devastate Laos and Cambodia too. US forces landed in Korea, occupied the southern part of the peninsula, suppressing the People's Committees and imposing a white terror, leading directly to a genocidal war 5 years later. The Philippines communists returned to armed struggle, this time against US neo-colonial domination in 1946. The leader of the Communist Party of Malaya, Chin Peng, was awarded the OBE, the Order of the British Empire, for his wartime role fighting the Japanese, but by 1948 was leading a renewed armed struggle against British imperialism and subsequently against neo-colonialism, one that was only finally curtailed with a peace agreement signed between the Communist Party of Malaya and the Malaysian government in southern Thailand in December 1989. In China, with Chiang Kai-shek refusing to abide by the outcome of the Chongqing negotiations and reverting to visceral anti-communist form, the Revolutionary Civil War broke out in 1946, leading 3 years later to the founding of the People's Republic of China, which stands today as the single greatest event in history's long march towards human liberation. To a great extent, all this could be and indeed was foreseen, displaying the strategic and tactical brilliance that consistently characterized his approach to international affairs. In his 1940 article on policy, Mao Zedong wrote as follows: "The Communist Party opposes all imperialism, but we make a distinction between Japanese imperialism, which is now committing aggression against China, and the imperialist powers which are not doing so now, between German and Italian imperialism, which are allies of Japan and have recognized Manchukuo, and British and US imperialism, which are opposed to Japan, and between the Britain and the United States of yesterday, which followed a Munich policy in the Far East and undermined China's resistance to Japan, and the Britain and the United States of today, which have abandoned this policy and are now in favor of China's resistance. Our tactics are guided by one and the same principle, to make use of contradictions, win over the many, oppose the few, and crush our enemies one by one. Viewed in this light, we can understand, although the Western powers and the Western media either could not or would not, why on the rostrum of Beijing's Tiananmen Square, on the 80th anniversary of the September 3rd victory, President Xi Jinping was flanked by Russia's Vladimir Putin and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea's Kim Jong-un, that the leaders of the United States, Britain, and other imperialist powers chose to absent themselves not only shows who truly carried the main burden of the anti-fascist struggle, but also who remains committed to upholding the truth and a correct understanding of World War II and its outcome, and hence to standing against fascism and war today. Thank you.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was World War Against Fascism, Remembering China's Role in the Victory, a webinar held by the International Manifesto Group and Friends of Socialist China on September 21st, 2025. We just heard Keith Bennett, co-editor of Friends of Socialist China. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.